Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 14th, 2005. Today's faculty meeting will be facilitated by Stacy Jutila, the village philosopher. The disc number is FO-2005-13.
There's a voice that we have to activate here. Antonio is our media ministry person who is taping our conversations. My name is Stacy Jutila, and I serve this week as the village philosopher. And as has been a tradition at Holden for a very long time, we are a place of conversation and a place that has forums, open conversations in the village on any number of topics. And we try to do that at least once or twice a week. And tonight's forum, I was thinking that it would be good to look at our summer theme, since this is the first full week of summer programming, and look at the idea of holy ground. I give thanks to all the teaching staff coordinators who have come up with good themes over the years that are rich and prove that it's possible to talk about things in a modern context, in the biblical context, political, personal, spiritual. And this one is follows in that way. Some of you have maybe been at the Bible studies this past week looking at the Exodus story where our theme is taken from, of Moses being on the mountainside, and he turns away from his work for a moment and sees the bush, the flaming bush, and is overcome with the awareness that God's presence is there. And God calls Moses, through the fiery bush, to take off his shoes because he is on holy ground. And I thought about that idea of holy ground, and I thought about it in our modern context. And you hear people at the lunch table here saying, "Oh, I just got back from Lyman Lake. It was so beautiful. I knew I was on holy ground up there." Or at the moment of celebration, whether it be a wedding or a birth, something that is a high point in someone's life, we can say, "That was holy ground." And in tonight's worship service, Rolf Begdahl led us in song and said, "Surely God is in this place. We are on holy ground." And my question has become, what is holy ground amidst the pain in life? And I know that many of you work for good causes in this world, in working for justice, working to overcome the brokenness in this world. And my question this week has been, how do we name and how do we see holiness in the brokenness in our world, whether it be on pavement or on the ground here at Holden, if there's brokenness here? And how do we turn away from our work long enough to take our shoes off and see and stay a while within the brokenness and find the holiness? And I hope that this is just a seed, this question of mine, for us to engage in conversation about holiness in the brokenness. And to prime the pump for our conversation and to provide a seed story, I'd like to share a clip from a film that has become a gift to me. When I'm not here at Holden, I'm studying and training to be a pastor and a chaplain, and I work in a children's hospital in Minnesota. And one of my nights, when I was in one of the sterile rooms in the hospital, there was, in the wee hours of the night, I sat with a little boy's parents, a little five-year-old boy, who was just diagnosed with a brain tumor, and the prognosis was very poor. And there were no words, and in that sterile room that night, it did not seem like it was a holy place. And it was hard, and there were many tears. And I left that night from the hospital feeling empty, feeling powerless, and wondering where God was in this place. And unbeknownst to me, I happened upon a movie the very next day up in Minneapolis called In America. Has anyone seen it? Okay. Okay, a few of you have. This movie is written by Jim Sheridan and his daughters. He did Angela's Ashes and My Left Foot. And it's a semi-autobiographical story of his sons dying of a brain tumor. And they're coming to America to create a new life for themselves. And they live in Hell's Kitchen in New York. I haven't been there. Maybe some of you have. But surely I wouldn't have considered this holy ground initially. But this scene that I will show in the movie is of a person busy at work who one could assume is living with AIDS. If you watch the whole movie, it's never said out loud, but it can be assumed that he is dying of AIDS. And two little girls knock on his door, and he turns away from his work. And he stops and turns from his ways of anger and finds holiness in the moment. So I will share this clip with you right now. Dan, would you mind shutting the lights off, please? Thank you.
Kids from upstairs?
Yeah.
Is this Halloween?
Yeah.
Where are you from?
You
came all the way to America to trick or treat? They are right now. Are they all right now?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I do. What's yours?
Tumor. And 3 years, it got bigger and bigger. It was malignant. Are you crying?
More of that with you. And if there's people that are interested in seeing that whole film, hopefully we can create a time for that. But someone back there that knows how to use the PowerPoint shut it off, please. Thank you. I think you have to turn it once more or press it there. Thank you. This story, unlike any story, has really challenged me to think about holy ground and brokenness. To see a man that was so full of anger and rage turn in a sudden moment and have tears and feel community and feel love, and in the rest of the movie that is further explored. But I've continued to question, how are our eyes attuned to find holy ground in broken places in this world, whether it be broken within our own hearts or in the world that we live in? And I invite people to share questions that you may have around the same idea, or stories of evidence in your life that holy ground does exist, that it is not forgotten ground where there is broken pavement. Sure. Dan, would you mind starting? He asked me to invite him to start, so I'm inviting Dan.
I'm too excited to just do it. But, this film inspired or brought the memory of a story in the parish that I served in Albuquerque, New Mexico in the 80s. And we were near down, well, I don't give a lot of details. It was a church, you know, that had a, it was a church.
here's the steeple.
It was one of those times I got the phone call at night, and there was a single mother on welfare who was a member of the church. She was white, and her husband had African American, so her two little boys, like 4 and 6, I think they were. And the phone call was that the younger of the two boys had been hit by a police car who was on a call, so was speeding, and the boy ran out between two cars and then died that night in the hospital. So I was with her, and then the next day, since it was a police car that had hit the boy, the chief of police came to the church and wanted to meet Millie and me. And so we met him, and this took me by total surprise, you know, because he wanted to express the sorrow of the police department. He's a tough man, but tough and tender. And I'll never forget looking into seeing his eyes when Millie surprised us all by just saying, "I forgive the police department, I forgive the officer who was driving the car." And then I saw tears coming down his cheeks, and then Millie had to leave, so the police officer stayed, and just said, "It's never happened before." And he says, "They always try to get us back. It's never happened." And then Then when the day of the funeral came and how the I looked out at the congregation, and then I saw in the back pew of the church all by himself a Hispanic man who was sitting there, and he was weeping. And I realized that it was the officer that had been driving the car. And then after the funeral service, when the family goes out towards the social hall for the lunch, I noticed Millie broke rank and down the pew, and then I saw her whisper something in his ear, and then I saw him get up and follow her out. So then I took my alb off and then went down to the social hall a few minutes later, and there at the dinner, he was sitting at the family table next to Millie. And I just looked at that sight because they were talking, and I could see in his face salvation or liberation, and the act of inviting him to meal. And when I looked at the two of them together, I just said, maybe next to the Eucharist, this is the closest I'll ever be to the reign of God. Mm-hmm. So it's a thanksgiving for a woman, poor, on welfare, grieving, and yet she turned that social hall and that table into the reign of God. So it was holy space. And I think if I go back to that church, I would still remember the spot. I mean, I'm not going to build a monument, but that spot would always bring tears again to my eyes. So I'm thankful for her and her witness.
Thank you, Dan.
Is holy ground seem real in that place, that it's even possible in places that it would be so easy to retaliate, so easy to lash out, that one takes their shoes off and is willing to stay there versus run and escape?
I had a couple of times when I actually lived down the streets, once in Spokane and once in Boulder, Colorado. And I was in Spokane a few years ago, staying at a women's shelter, and we could go in at 8 at night and they'd make sure we left by 8 in the morning. And one morning I was walking from the women's shelter and walked past the men's shelter and walked under this overpass. And every morning there were some guys drinking there at like 8 a.m. You know, and they were just drinking and cursing and stuff, and it always bothered me to walk past them. And one day I was tired of how much it bothered me, how much it was, I knew I was thinking incorrectly, so I tried to get really quiet and listen, and it occurred to me how much pain I'd have to be in to start self-medicating that early in the morning. Mm-hmm. And suddenly I felt very compassionate towards them, and I went back and I just joked with them. They offered me a drink, I didn't really care for one, but I just talked to them and just saw them as my brothers, and suddenly that was very much a holy instant for me. Mm-hmm. There was one other time in Boulder, and I have some inner guidance, and sometimes it's pretty strong, but I was literally had a sleeping bag hidden somewhere, but I was using this guidance to hold up a cardboard sign on a corner, and I had a few dollars in my pocket, and I really didn't need to buy anything, and that was the last thing I wanted to do. That seemed like a rock bottom type thing, but I was really getting this inner guidance to do it. I didn't want to write like, I need money because I didn't feel like I did, but I wanted to write something, so I wrote, love what you don't understand, understand what you love. And I think it was one of the hardest things I've ever done was to walk up to that corner with all these cars going by and hold up that sign. And most people didn't even look at me, but I really tried to look at them, I tried to love them. You know, the Bible says it's easy to love those who love you. To me, great was the one who could love them even though they didn't acknowledge my presence. And a little bit of classism here, but pretty much almost exclusively the more expensive cars didn't acknowledge me, but the least expensive cars did look at me. And one person apologized, he didn't have any money. One guy in a nice truck, he rolled down his window and meant to hand me a dollar. And I said, no, I just want you to read my sign. And he had this real confused look on his face. But it got easier and easier, but it was really hard. And I was standing there for maybe about half an hour and trying to just be present. And suddenly someone comes up and taps on my shoulder. And I turn around, and it was this tiny Hispanic woman. And she's holding out this dollar to me. And I just felt so moved because, I mean, she was on foot. She didn't have some nice car. And I took it, and she just had this biggest grin on her face, and I got this huge grin on my face. And she turned around and walked away, and she had this cleaning service on the back of her shirt. She basically worked for a cleaning service, didn't have a car, probably didn't have much money at all, but she gave me a dollar. I just had to leave and go somewhere and cry because I was so moved. And so that was very much holy ground. That was in a city with me holding that cardboard sign. I'm very grateful for that.
Could you say once more what was on the sign?
Yeah. Love what you don't understand, understand what you love.
Okay. It's interesting because the story that our summer theme is based on is one of Moses being alone. He walked away from the herds, went up, it was on the mountain by himself. But the stories that have been shared so far of recognizing holy ground have been in surprising moments in brokenness when others have been there. And I know that, or I hope that broken holy ground can be discovered in solitude, yet it's the three examples so far have been ones that have been communal at some level. And then my question is, does it take a community to recognize holy ground in broken places?
I don't know, though. To be fair to the Moses story, he encountered God, so it was communal, right?
True.
It was a total solitude,
yes.
In the sense that Moses was by himself. He was there with God.
Yes.
So.
Yes. Well, for me, the most profound spiritual experiences have been in relation with people. I'm from Minnesota, and I was driving from my home in southern Minnesota to Minneapolis several years ago, and I wasn't in a big hurry. There was a big gap in front of me, and I saw some workmen crossing the road with something. And there was a patrol car up ahead, and he stepped out in the road, and I was the first person in line to stop. And he was a real, real big patrolman. And so I slowed down, and he came up and kind of apologetically said, well, they're putting a new power line across the interstate, and so I'll need to stop you. And I said, well, that's all right. And the weather was okay, and so I just felt like visiting with him. And I, only a few days before, just a few miles north of this spot where we were, a young teenager had a stolen car that he'd driven 100 miles an hour into a sheriff's deputy's car and killed the deputy. And I mentioned that to the officer, and I said, did you know him? And he looked really sad, and he said, I was there. And I said, I'm so sorry. And so we chatted a little bit more, and then the workman finished, and he said, okay, you can go ahead. And he walked around the front of my car, stood over behind his car, and as we parted, as I left, I waved a little to him, and our eyes met. It was just like electricity. I mean, it was such an enormous spiritual experience of having that person feel that at least one person felt some sympathy for him and some gratitude for someone who had given their life and showed some kindness. And it cost me nothing. It cost me nothing to have done what I did. And yet, the spirituality that came from that was just so enormous. I don't think I've ever had a stronger spiritual experience. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know that a lot of us plan for the next time that we can come up to Holden, and maybe for some of you this is the first time. And I've talked with people that I know from Holden who have spent years planning for the time that they'll be on long-term staff here and live for a year and make it right for their family. And we all know the travel that is involved to get to this place and the effort to come here. Yet we all, one way or another, have worked hard and look forward to coming to this place. Yet here at Holden, community isn't perfect. That we find, that we wrestle, we find the person that shows us the ugliest parts of ourselves that is a mirror for us. I think of when I lived here in Winter Community a few years back, there was one person that we just clashed on everything possible. And I would do my very best to not sit with this person at the dining table or in the dining room, not next to them at Vespers. I would avoid them at all costs because there was something that was just so disagreeable for me. It was very hard. And I was getting to the end of my time that I was living on long-term staff here. And I felt that I wanted to have some resolution and not walk away from Holden with such bitterness. But I couldn't do it no matter how hard I tried. I found one more reason why I wasn't going to get along with this person. And just where this light is coming right down there, we were having Eucharist one Sunday. In the winter, we worship in this space. And I always drink from the common cup. And we were singing, and I was going around the fire ring. I went to drink from the common cup. And who was holding the common cup that day? But the person that I had avoided all winter long, the person that I did not want to sit next to. And for me, when you talked about face to face, we had to look eye to eye. And I would have loved to leap over this fire ring here and go back to my seat because there was some frustration there. But for me, the holy ground, the fire came down in between us. And it wasn't this person's action or mine that reconciled, but that God brought us face to face. And I was frozen for a moment there. And I come back to that question of community, of the aspect of finding holy ground amidst brokenness. That moment over there, just on the other side of that statue, that's still holy ground to me each time I walk into this room. I don't know if Holden or other communities have been like that for you.
I had a person like that when I lived here.
I hope it wasn't me.
What was this other person's name?
Or just their initials.
Yeah. They were taller than you.
I appreciate that story because it's holy ground that's also uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. I think that comes out a little bit in the Moses story too. I mean, it's not like standing and looking at a beautiful mountain exactly. Mm-hmm. It's more like, you know, here's something bizarre happening and now this voice is asking me to do stuff I wouldn't want to do. Mm-hmm. And I think holy ground, especially in the kind of places that you're raising this question about, you know, the hard places, I think it can often be like that. I think about, I live in a house of hospitality, and so one of the things we're always reminding each other of is that whoever shows up at our door is liable to be Jesus, you know, and that's Matthew 25. But if you read the Matthew 25 story, where you know Jesus says you did it to the least of these, you did it to me. He said it to both crowds, and both of them were surprised. And I think that's right. We never get it. You never know when the person shows up to the center of Jesus, and often they're just offensive. You know, they rub you all the wrong way, and then they walk away, and you say, "Well, that was God." My, you know. And I think holy ground often works like that. We don't know it's holy until we've already passed by, and then, I just thought it was an annoying stranger stepping by.
So there sometimes isn't even time for us to take off our shoes. We're already walking before we recognize that it's holy.
Yeah. And holiness, after all, isn't all that exciting. I mean, really, holiness. It's always, you know, fire, and it seemed like it would hurt.
I've been thinking about a story about, I don't want to interrupt you, though.
No, please, tell your story.
I have a younger brother who's 2 years younger than I am, and we have had this very intense relationship our whole lives together, and just used to beat the crap out of each other growing up, and I took a trip to New York to visit him in like maybe 2 or 3 years ago, and we got into one of our famous fights, and I have no idea what the topic was. I mean, I'm sure it was something incredibly petty too. We were gonna go to Coney Island. We got into this big fight, and my brother made me stop my car. I was driving, and he got out in the middle of Brooklyn. I was gonna walk back to his apartment, and I drove back to his place and went up and started packing up my stuff, just like throwing it in my suitcase, and was gonna drive back to Michigan. And I don't know how we got there, but eventually the two of us were sitting in the front seat of my car, and I think we had this realization that, at least I remember thinking, if we don't talk about this stuff now, we might lose our relationship. Look up, you know? And we spent 2 or 3 hours in the front seat of my car hashing out our entire childhoods, every wrong that we had done to one another, like, you know, from the time that he smashed all my dollhouse furniture to horrible things that I did to him. And we just laid it out in the most honest way. And we talked really for the first time about my father's death in 1988. We talked about his recovery from alcoholism. I talked about things that had gone on in my life. I'm not too afraid to share right now, but it was holy, I guess, because I don't think I had the courage to do that by myself. I couldn't have done it and talked about all the stuff that we did. And it reminds me of one of my favorite books and one of the favorite passages in it, which is Traveling Mercies by Anne Lamott. And in the beginning, she's this, she calls it what does she call the opening section? She calls it like the prelude, I think.
Prologue.
And she has this moment of conversion where she feels like Jesus has been following her around like this little cat, and she can't get rid of him. And what are her cool liberal friend's gonna think if she says she's a Christian, which I resonate with a lot. And she turns to the wall and she says, fuck it, I quit. Which I think is like one of the most holy points in that book, because it's like, I mean, it's like the, whatever, first
she
chapter.
She took her shoes off there.
Yeah. And I think the part that I'm resonating with the most about that is the risk involved in taking your shoes off. That, and the vulnerability of it, and the tenderness, and the pain, and everything else.
I was part of the winter community that she read Whole List. And we walked on a whole lot of holy ground. Hard to even describe how that holy ground worked, except that there is a body of women, particularly, who are willing to share their stories with us, and their pain, and their alienation from our Lutheran church as women who are lesbian and in committed relationships, and who we lived with intimately and knew that Ellen and Jane love each other, and that Sonia and Stacy Jo love each other. It was incredibly powerful to hear their voices and watch their pain. And we had 3 meetings in the course of it in which people shared their stories, and again would be caught up in their weeping. By the time we got to talk to David Christian, our sisters and brothers who are lesbian or gay or transgendered in this village didn't have to speak anymore. When we talked to David Christian, it was the 4th meeting of tearfulness. But it was mostly the straight community who said, this is their story, and this is what we need, and this is what it means to be fully alive and fully human, is to be accepted on both sides of this communion table. And I can't pinpoint where the holy ground was in a particular instance, but it was life-changing for me to be part of this journey this winter. Simply life-changing. Holy ground.
Your story, Gail, makes me wonder about the political power dynamics in a holy ground situation. Because you've all been able to share stories, and sharing the story recognize the holy in your midst. But no decisions have been made to actually change the decisions that make them feel excluded still.
In the whole church.
No. In the whole church, yeah. So it's I'm interested in when the ground is made holy by the people who are being oppressed themselves, irregardless of whether the people in power that are doing the oppression actually change or have any reconciliation with them. There's a power that's different, that claims the holiness regardless of the oppression, I think. I'm thinking about that myself.
So you're saying, Mike, that the naming of the holy ground is by the experienced person and not by the powers that be?
Well, yeah. I mean, we've had stories of... Hi, Mike. Okay. We've had stories of...
That was a holy moment there.
Yeah. Where there's a reconciliation that's taken place, mm-hmm. Or an acknowledgement of pain that's shared. Mm-hmm. That opens up the holy. But I've seen and experienced times when it's more like that,
Once when I was in Chicago, I'd spent a whole day going around with a PR guy from the suburbs who was going to help us tell the story of hungry people in Chicago. And we had a photographer along with us. So we went to a meal program on the south side, to an after-school program on the west side, to another place on the northwest side. We're going all over the whole day. And just the massiveness of poverty in Chicago was overwhelming to me, and I'd already lived there for 8 months. And the photographer and the PR guy were really caught off guard. They're, whoa, what's going on in our city? And then they went home, and I was worn out. But I, that evening, had to go for the food bank that I was working at to a reception on the 44th floor of the corporate headquarters of Sara Lee Foods. And there on the corporate walls were impressionist paintings, like Monet and Manet and Renoir, all around us in these beautifully paneled walls. And the vice presidents and the presidents were all there to welcome our new executive director, fighting for hunger, or to the end of hunger in Chicago. And we had wine glasses on the table and clinking things and hors d'oeuvres being served on trays. And I didn't feel it was holy at all. I was so angry that here we were on the 44th floor celebrating our goodness. And people were massively hungry and in poverty in Chicago. And I still don't get it up there on the 44th floor. And yet, hearing some of these stories tonight makes me realize maybe not on the 44th floor, but I had been on holy ground in other places that day that were holy regardless of whether or not anybody else on the 44th floor recognized it, I think. So I think
part of the thing for me was the holy ground is in the moment of my reckoning, mm-hmm. and in the moment of my changing. Mm-hmm. That when I understood and sat in a session in which the women in the room who happened to all be lesbian were explaining how when they fall in love with someone, they have to wait with trepidation at the reaction of their family. And I, as a straight woman, go, well, I fell in love with Scott. It was kind of a celebration. Great. And I got to assume all that. And so just little moments of that kind of click, click, click of understanding, I actually think those are also a place of holy ground where you go, oh, you know, kind of your get it. Mm-hmm. I get it. Because you actually don't go backwards from those. Mm-hmm. Really.
So many of these stories that we're sharing are, as Mike and Gail and others have shared, are about reconciliation. And I tried not to put you on the spot too much, but I know that you've done some work looking at the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa, but what have you learned of the role of reconciliation in the aspect of Holy Ground?
Oh, I don't know about Holy Ground. And probably plenty of people here that know as much or more about the TRC as myself. There are several stories that are very famous that have been circulated that sound like the stories that are in the room tonight. One thing that's remarkable is how many people who were central to organizing that and spent the most time listening to all the stories have got sick and died. And the only real explanation is the toll that it took upon them to listen to all that stuff.
Is everyone familiar with the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in South Africa? What happened after apartheid, of the truth-telling of the victim families of victims, largely?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was, they knew that they could not start a new life as a nation with all the memories of what had happened to people untended. Mm-hmm. And so they organized a whole system of amnesty hearings, basically, is what they were, where people could come and just say out loud in front of the people who had been affected the truth about what they had done. And then sometimes there was reparation that could be made, sometimes there was nothing that could be done. But everyone listened to everyone else's story of what had happened to them and what they had done. I mean, there's one famous story that I'm sure some of you have heard of a woman, a 70-year-old woman, was brought together with a policeman who had come to her house one day and hauled her teenage son out of the house. And while she and her husband stood at the door of the house, the policeman simply shot the young man through the head and left his body there for them to do something with. And about a year or whatever later, the same policeman came back and took her husband away. And he didn't shoot him on the spot, but just took him away, and she assumed the same thing had happened. And about a year or so later, the same policeman came back and got her. And she thought she was going to be taken off to be shot. And the policeman took her to a place and showed her that her husband was alive. And she was astonished to see him alive, but the policeman immediately proceeded to pour a can of gasoline over him and lit him on fire so that she had to watch him die. And then he let her go. And this story, I don't remember now whether she told the story or he told the story, but he admitted to his part in this whole story in front of this woman and all her friends and some other policemen who had had other parts to this story. And then the presiding person at the hearing asked the woman, "What do you want?" And she said, "I want three things. I want, first of all, to be taken to where my husband was burned, so that if there are any ashes left, I can collect his ashes, and I can give them a proper burial if possible. Second, I would like this policeman to know that I forgive him, even as Christ has forgiven me for everything that I have done sinful in my life. And third," she said, "my husband and my son were all I had in the whole world. I have no other family, and I have really nothing else but my own life and my house. And so I would like this policeman to be my son, so that I have someone on whom to bestow the love that I still have to give in what's left of my life. And so I would like him to come to my house once a year, and I would like to feed him a meal, and I would like to sit and talk with him and love him and give him gifts." And the policeman fainted. And while they revived the policeman, the woman's friends began to sing Amazing Grace. That's one of the more famous stories to come out of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. But there's been a lot of controversy about it because obviously there's a whole lot of stuff that happened about which there was no justice. There was only amnesty. And who have listened to all this, who still want justice. And as I said, so many of the people who ran the hearings and did all the presiding have got sick and died just from all the poison.
I don't know how to follow after that, to know that deep of brokenness. Yet we sit here sharing stories, hoping that we are not solitary pilgrims on the road, on the Holden Road, and on the road that goes back down Lake. And we come here for renewal of mind, body, and spirit. I wonder how, whether it be here at Holden or these other places, whether it be in Colorado or back in Minnesota or in South Africa, how we go forth from those points of recognizing holy ground and have our eyes and our hearts attuned that it can happen again. Because I think, like Jonathan said, sometimes I get past it, and then I'm like, oh, that's what that was all about. And then I fall back into my broken ways, my sinful ways, and just because there's been some reconciliation with the person that was standing right there with me, there's another person in another community that I encounter with just as intensive traits that grate on me, or that I have done something wrong to them. And I don't know if my lenses, maybe I need to get different glasses of seeing, being ready and open to see holiness on the ground that we walk on. You know, people have thoughts in that area.
One of the things from what you said earlier, Stacy, that resonates with me is something that's very comforting in the Holden Village propaganda is where it says that Holden is not perfect. And I gave that presentation on what you need to know about scientists and how we think. And to me, if I hear some sort of group think that says that something is perfect, I take it as a challenge. And having it explicitly admitted that this is not a perfect place relieves me of having to find fault with it and enables me to enjoy what's good about it.
If you missed that clause and you were coming for the first time, we don't give money back if you were expecting the
Sorry about that.
Yeah. I have a totally different kind of story, because when you announced this last night as a broken sidewalk thing, I come from literalist people, so I took the literal. In the summer, this is radically different thing, but in the summer of 94, I was up there with my family. My children were real small. In Lake July, Chelan was surrounded by fire. Leavenworth was surrounded by fire. The village was full of smoke. There was ashes coming down. If you stood still, you were covered with ashes. It was like snow. And the census in the village got down to about 150 because no one could come in anymore. And Janet Grant had just become the director, and she was in the village, and she had just got here. And they were deciding whether or not to evacuate us. And a Forest Service woman, officer who was up here at the time, living in the cottage up there, and Janet asked all the adults in the village that the one night to please put the children to bed and meet in the village center. And so we sat in the village center, and this woman from the Forest Service began to instruct us what to do, depending upon what happened next. And if the fire came from this direction, you do this, and if the fire comes from that direction, you do another thing. And if the fire came up the road, what we did was go to the tailings. Now we're gonna spend millions of dollars to get rid of those suckers. And they are a big ugly scar, but in the summer of 94, they would have saved our lives. I've never thought about them in the same sense.
Is that holy ground?
That's my question.
That's pretty ugly.
Yes, but I didn't ask you to tell. Yes, please do.
It's a happy story.
Okay.
It shows, I think, that holy ground can also be very, very, very positive. Mm-hmm. And I was on a trip to Colorado and then up to eastern Nebraska to visit relatives with my brother and my niece, the three of us. And driving back, my brother's in Oregon, so we were driving from eastern Nebraska to Portland. And our first day, we drove from eastern Nebraska to Rawlins, Wyoming, which is a long, it's a good. So we pull in to this town, and we decided we wanted Mexican food, so we started asking them around, and everybody said, go to Rose's. So we went to Rose's and we pulled in, and we were glad the lights were on, but then we noticed the family was painting out by the front door. And so we drove near them, and the owner came to our car window. We rolled it down, and we said, we asked if they're closed, and they said, we closed 2 hours ago, we're painting. And so we said, are there any good restaurants in town we could go to? And he says, there aren't any good restaurants in this town. So then he looked in the car and says, you really look tired. How long have you been driving? And I said, eastern Nebraska. And he says, why don't you come in? So we followed him into the restaurant, and it had 7 stools and 1 booth. So he sits down in the booth and got acquainted, and he introduced us to the family. And then he said, just wait here. Then he went into the kitchen, and he came out with a great big, one of those long oval platters just filled with Mexican food. This was about 20 minutes later, you know, and set it down in front of us and brought pop. And then we ate and talked about families, and the younger people came and talked to us, his wife talked to us. And then it was time to go, you know, so because we were tired and wanted to get to the motel. And so I says, well, we're ready for our check. And he just looked at me, check? He said, you're my guests. I invited you here. And so the point of the story is, of course that was holy ground. And he said, you know, if you want to pay for this meal, go out and do something kind to somebody else. So, so my reason for telling this story, if you're ever in Rawlins, go to Rose's. That's the only part.
2 hours after closing.
Yeah, well, try to get there on time. Okay. 5 hours. Go to Rose's and just look around and say, this is holy ground.
That phrase is an observation that seems apparent to me of all the stories today, that there's an element of surprise in Holy Ground. It's not something you can plan or predict. And certainly that was true for Moses. Why he happened to be aware of the burning bush, I suppose we could conjecture that. But he was at the right place at the right time and willing to see flames where no one else saw flames, and willing to see burning where consumption didn't occur. And he was surprised at what came out of it. I've had opportunity in the last several weeks and months to have many spaces of holy ground, and it's always a surprise. I understand that the word for, the root word for joy is surprise. Same word. And so Jesus said, I pray that their joy, their surprise will be full. And that's where we find the Holy Ground.
Thank you.
I appreciate what Gail shared, and I wish I could say, I'll have to say to her at another point, but I'll say it to you that moment of you'll never be the same after being surprised in that way. And as people have shared their stories, they sound, Rose's sounded like you were there yesterday or last week, or Carrie, as you talked about Brooklyn, it seemed like it could have been last week, that it stays with us. And I think of the disciples on the road to Emmaus in the book of Luke, who said, were not our hearts burning within us when he walked on the road with us, when Jesus appeared to them, and they first did not recognize him, but their eyes, their hearts were opened in the breaking of the bread in their meal, not at Rose's, but in another place. And there was surprise there, I think.
And joy.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a sense, though, in some of the cases that people who participate, I mean, I think if we went to some of these people and said, would you consider this holy ground? They go, what do you mean? I mean, it sometimes is, it may be holy to us, but it may not be necessarily perceived as holy by the other people in the encounters, which is kind of an interesting, I mean, it opens up holiness to be something that we can encounter in everyday things. I mean, I think back to sort of a dumb little thing I did when, at the end of my campus ministry time, I was kind of debriefing and trying to figure out, you know, what was effective and what didn't work. And I'd given lots of talks and led Bible studies and organized conferences. And invariably, every time I talked to the student, it was some conversation that struck them, or seeing me do dishes. They'd never seen an egalitarian marriage, or these things that I was oblivious to. But for them, that was sort of the moment where something real happened for them in the everydayness that, you know, if you'd asked me that, I would have said, those weren't holy moments. There were a lot of, you know, sort of probably problematic moments they were sort of reading into, but there is a way in which we may be oblivious to the very ways in which we can have these encounters. That doesn't mean that we should look for them and appreciate and tell people when we have them, but there is that oddness to that too.
Well,
yes, you have time for just a brief story of burning bush that was not consumed?
Yes, please. It'll be our parting story, unless there's one more that someone would like to share.
Just tell you briefly why this story of Moses has had special meaning in the last years. June and I spent a year teaching in Namibia, which is wilderness or desert, sort of a cross between. And for example, there was a river that was wide as a football field is long, that did not have a drop of water all year. So this was dry terrain. And because on Sunday morning, the worship service at the school where we were, which was not in a town center, was just out in the middle of this desert wilderness, was in a local language, we had developed the custom of early on Sunday morning walking out through the desert and then going up on one of these high rock outcroppings that we have and have our devotions and sing hymns and just be there. And the one Sunday where it had been the winter and everything was barren and dry and dusty and no light and no light. And as we turned aside to come down off of this rocky outcropping, our eyes just suddenly glanced, and there was a burning bush. And as we watched, it was not consumed. And as we walked towards it, knowing, of course, that it wasn't a burning bush, but that's just what struck us as we turned, I still recall this sense. This is holy ground. And what it was springtime was coming, and this bush, when nothing else had any life on it, had burst out with red-orange flowers. It just looked like this great burning bush. And the reminder that in this barrenness and in the frustration sometimes and the loneliness of this setting, here was holy ground. But it always has been my reminder that we have had our burning bush.
Thank you, Carolyn. I'm thinking just like that, or similar to that, Annie Dillard in The Pilgrim at Tinker Creek, she's an author, has a story of the tree with lights in it. And it's almost a burning bush experience for her. And she, and I may misquote her, and I apologize if I do, but it's something to the effect of, I was about like a bell struck for the very first time and did not know it. And that encounter of the burning bush. Well, I thank you all for being a part of this holy space. And I hope that your eyes and hearts are continually surprised by the gift of God's holiness. Thank you.